This may not be the most pleasant of subjects to talk about because it taps into the deepest part of our emotions. And although it's not something that's very pleasant to contemplate, it is something that I would guess everyone in this audience has experienced as an emotion. So it may dredge up some bad memories to talk about this particular thing, and it may dredge up some very difficult emotional response. But probably everyone in the audience has suffered from some kind of betrayal while they've lived on this earth. Betrayal is one of those things that affects all of humankind, and it can even affect little kids in the audience. Have you ever had somebody break a confidence of a shared secret? Perhaps you have been the subject of gossip or a rumor or the object of a spread rumor. Well, if you can just tap into that for a second, can you remember how deeply heartbroken you were as a result of that betrayal, whatever it was? Yes? No? Not good, right? Not good at all. History records some monumental betrayals, and these betrayals affected the lives of hundreds, thousands, and millions of people. Of course, there is, in Roman history, the famous example of Brutus, Marcus Brutus, who is the close friend of Julius Caesar. But he was convinced to lead a rebellion against his friend, and you know, they all stabbed him at the end and killed Caesar because they were convinced Caesar would be bad for the Republic as a dictator, and that's not what they wanted. And so the famous words, "Et tu, Brutus, you too, my closest friend, my closest confidant," one of the most famous phrases uttered in history by one who was betrayed by his close friend. There was the Aztec woman Doña Marina, who is viewed as a betrayer by her native peoples in Mexico because she consorted with the Spanish conquistador Hernando Cortez. And using her ability to translate from her native Aztec tongue and communicate with the translator of the Spanish conquistador enabled Cortez to conquer New Spain or Mexico. And so she was viewed by her people as a traitor. Now, a name that's synonymous in American history with traitor is Benedict Arnold. And you know the history of Benedict Arnold. You don't even have to know what he did to know that that name is a synonym for a traitor and a betrayer. And in truth, he fought very valiantly on the American side for independence for a while, but then switched sides. And actually, his betrayal didn't work out so well, even though he got 20,000 pounds from the British to betray one of our forts on the Hudson River. But his plot was discovered. He lived out his life in England as a traitor and on the losing side. Marshal Pétain was the premier of France who in 1940 went to Berlin to meet with Hitler and announced upon his return that France would become a collaborator with the Nazis. And he gave a whole new meaning, a sinister one, to the word collaborator. The French collaborators in World War II were the traitors to their country, to their people, to their nation. And a little bit during that time, Tokyo Rose. Everybody knows who Tokyo Rose. I mean, if you had any history taught to you in high school or college, you know who Tokyo Rose was. She was a disc jockey in Japan. She was born in Los Angeles in 1916. She happened to be in Tokyo when the war broke out, and she became a disc jockey, and she became synonymous for one who was trying to convince the Americans in the Pacific to give up. And so she broadcast propaganda to try to convince them over the airwaves that they should just lay down their arms. They had no chance of victory. She was convicted of treason in 1949, sentenced to 10 years in prison, served 6 years of that prison term. And I had forgotten this. She was pardoned by President Ford in 1977. I have no idea why she was pardoned. It seems to me she was guilty as charged, but President Ford pardoned her. And then, of course, the most famous traitor and betrayer of all history until today, Judas Iscariot. Whether it happens to you individually or to nations, an act of betrayal can change the course of history. Either your personal history or the lives of hundreds, thousands, or millions. So today we're here to celebrate the Day of Atonement. It will be the beginning of a separation that occurred because of betrayal, a void between God and man, thus the term at-one-ment. Can't be possible until the source of that betrayal that separated man from God is exposed and dealt with. But the void exists today because God was betrayed. The God family, the Father, the Son, were betrayed anciently, long ago. Can you imagine the feeling of the betrayal the God family felt because of the iniquity, the injustice, and the betrayal by one that they created? Turn to the book of Proverbs, chapter 6. There's a poetic theme to this particular proverb. It's used elsewhere in the Bible. It is used for emphasis in each of the cases where it lists six things and then one additional thing. It says, "These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren." The proud look is applied in Isaiah chapter 10. If you want to look up Isaiah 10, it's used in the context of a conquering king and the pride and the attitude that this particular king had. Isaiah chapter 10 and verse 12 says, "Therefore it shall come to pass when the Lord has performed all his work on Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that he will say, I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his haughty look. For he says, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent. And I have removed the boundaries of the people, and I have robbed their treasuries, so I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. My hand has found like a nest the riches of the people. And as one gathered eggs that are left, I have gathered all the earth." Selfish, wanton ambition, a proud look. I took it, I did it, because I could. Now, there have been many dictators, there have been many deviants throughout history who have had that attitude. And God hates it, hates that attitude. A lying tongue, somebody that deceives and betrays. Hands that shed innocent blood. Well, we know that murder was specifically prohibited after the flood, and it was prohibited, and the authority was given to mankind to rule and judge himself and devise ways and means to take care of murderers. But this goes even further, the killing and the slaughter of innocents, and history is littered with the rampages of despots who have killed innocent people in a wanton fashion. All of that happens because of one who betrayed God. Heart that devises wicked plans. So the intent here is the heart and the will is focused on evil, even as it was just before the flood, and God had to destroy all of mankind because that was the intent, that was the desire, that is the way man had gone. Feet swift in running to evil, the enthusiasm, the zeal to bring pain to others. This is macabre. This is strange. This is a strange way of thinking. But I'm sure each of you can remember a time when somebody actually had pleasure in bringing pain to someone else and did that. A false witness who speaks lies, just pouring out lies in abundance is the intent, and sowing discord among the brethren. Could be generating false information or generating true information mixed with false information that should not be shared, which has happened, or an amalgamation of error and truth mixed together to give the appearance of validity, but it leads the individual to a wrong conclusion. It's one of the worst and most heinous of crimes, sowing discord among the brethren. The law of God clearly defines this area as well as the previous six attitudes. You've read John 8 and verse 44, where Christ addressed the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He said this, you may have wondered about it. You are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth because there is no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks it from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. So in what way was the devil a murderer? Well, we know that it goes back to the Garden of Eden. We know they lied, but he didn't physically take up a knife or a club and beat mankind to death or kill somebody himself in that way, did he? But he did murder the human race. He did murder the human race's potential at that time with cunning deception and the intent to do everything within his power with all the descriptors of Proverbs 6 brought into play. Sly, cunning, evil. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 2. This beautiful time in the Garden of Eden, in paradise, everything beautiful, everything pure, wonderful environment, all created for mankind. Verse 1, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he had rested from all his work which God had created and made. This is the history of the heavens and the earth in which they were created, in the day that the Lord God made the earth and the heavens. And a great contribution that Mr. Armstrong made was the understanding and the analysis of Genesis 1. Genesis 1:1, where it says, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Everything God creates is good, as he explains later in the chapter. He stands back, he looks at it, it was good. But between verse 1 and 2, a significant event occurred because the earth became void. It was confused, it was a mess, it was wrecked. And there was darkness on the face of the deep. And God recreated, as we have been taught, there was a recreation of that destruction that took place at some particular point in time. And then God fixed it all up, recreated it, formed it, made it beautiful, perfect environment. And right smack dab in the Garden of Eden, it says in verse 8, the Lord God planted eastward a garden eastward in Eden, and there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the Lord God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life was also in the midst of the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And I mentioned last time in the sermon that God didn't create evil. He created choice. He allowed choice. And there has to be that choice in order for there to be the development of character to choose right and wrong. And so into this beautiful environment, obviously, Adam was given the opportunity to name the animals, which he did. Named the creation. God gave that opportunity to him. And then he made a woman. They were perfectly matched. I had the opportunity to be with co-workers this week, and got a couple of people on my team that have gone through divorce and never gone into the details or anything, but then, you know, they've gotten through the difficult times of divorce, and they're discussing amongst themselves. I'm just kind of viewing all of this, watching what's happened. They're discussing one of the teammates has put another one's profile on Match.com and eHarmony, and she said, "Yeah, I didn't want you to do that." You know, she knew that she had done it, but you know, and then they're just, it's kind of funny watching their protests, but that's become a means by which people get to know one another and meet mates. And I guess it's worked for a lot of people, but we're talking how it has worked for them. But one was protesting. She didn't want to do this. They get all kinds of candidates that aren't so great. And so it was kind of funny listening to them talk about their situation. But we didn't need any Match.com in the Garden of Eden. God chose the right two people for each other, obviously. At the height of intellect and wisdom from a human standpoint, but very, very vulnerable, as we know. And in Genesis 3, the serpent comes on the scene, and we know the rest of the story. But the devil is a murderer because of what he told Eve in verse 4. The serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die. You will not surely die. For God knows that in the day that you eat, your eyes will be opened, and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil." And so it began. The deception began. Now, you can read through the genealogy in chapter 4 or chapter 5. The genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in his likeness of God. He created them male and female. Blessed them and called them mankind in the day they were created. Pardon me. And Adam lived 130 years and begot a son in his own image, and after his image named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam, pardon me, were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. He died. And you read through the rest of the genealogy, and little by little, lifespans get a little by little, but each one dies. The devil lied and deceived and betrayed the instruction that God had given to Adam and Eve. These two were so innocent. But the destroyer was intent on destroying God's plan of salvation. And so he got in between God's instruction and law and sowed the seeds of discord between them and God. In his dialogue with Job, in Job chapter 38, let's please turn there. In his dialogue with Job, God infers a time of peace, a time in which he brought the material universe into being, which shows that there is validity to that gap between verses 1 and 2 of Genesis 1. Because the implication is that when it first all came into being, it was magnificent, but then destroyed. Job 38 and verse 4, obviously God is challenging Job for a different purpose here. I just want to focus in on something a little bit later. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together. Morning stars are the angels of God. And all the sons of God shouted for joy. So the Bible implies a time in which the earth was created and all God's sons or angelic beings were in unity, in harmony, and shouted for joy at all that had been brought into creation. The material, the physical, which wasn't there before. The implication is also that these angelic beings knew the purpose for this matter to be brought into existence. And that there was a plan, there was a blueprint, if you will, for the reproduction of the God kind. And that it was in play after the creation of the angelic beings. And then the material universe came into being, and the earth along with it. Which leads us to the book of John, chapter 1. In the beginning, when was that? In the beginning. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The focus that John places is on the Creator. The focus that John is placing and not is on who and what Jesus Christ was prior to his material existence. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made. This word is the one that confronted Job. This word is the one that was responsible for the action of the creation of all that is material. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. And the light shines in darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John, John the Baptist, who prepared the way. But the beginning of John, the beginning of Genesis, help us to understand what happened, to put along with other passages, that this orb that we live on was created for mankind as a dwelling place. It's hard for man to concentrate on this earth as the focal point of life. It's hard because they continually want to... Are we having technical issues here or something? Are we still okay? We're all right? Okay. It's hard for man to look at this earth as the focal point of everything. It's hard for him to imagine that this earth could be the centerpiece of God if they believe in God. Man wants to get off this earth. Man wants to go explore the stars. Man wants to go to Mars. We've been to Moon. Now they want to go to Mars, although all odds are against the ability to even do that. Setting up a colony on Mars where there's no environment with which to do that. We can't even replicate, after spending billions of dollars, we can't even replicate Earth on Earth. They tried it at the biosphere, which I think is a great experiment in the inability of man to be able to do what he wants to do. This was, you remember, founded by a billionaire from Texas many years ago whose determination was that, yeah, we need to get off this earth. We need to leave. We need to get away from all of these problems. Except we always take all these problems with us and replicate them elsewhere. But it's not going to happen. It can't happen. I mean, even the idea of space travel, as fast as man can get and become mobile in space, there's no friction or anything else, takes years to get to Mars, millions and millions of miles away. And then to think that we would be able to set up a habitat somehow when we can't even replicate it on this Earth under the most ideal conditions. Remember the first time Terry and I visited the place up in Oregon? We were astounded by how thin the people were. And then somebody did something, and they're working in there, cut a finger or something, had to be taken to an emergency room. First thing they did was stop at McDonald's before they went back to before they went back to the biosphere. It was big news many, many years ago, 20 years ago or so, whenever it happened. But those folks were thin, and they had every advantage of being able to take into this environment and build an environment from scratch, but they couldn't do it. So it's very difficult for people to think, or scientists or great minds to think, that this Earth was the focal point of everything that God is doing, because the universe is so huge. It's so magnificent. How could this be the only place in which there are these conditions? Because they're thinking of the mathematical probability, and they're thinking of time and chance. There obviously must be some place out there that could sustain human life in the same proportions of oxygen and carbon dioxide and fresh water. But they haven't found it. I doubt they ever will. They haven't found it. They've found what they think might be, but there's no clear proof that there is anything in the billions of similar shaped bodies in other places in the galaxies that actually could do what this Earth does. But that's hard for people to conceive, because they might believe in this kind of accidental happenstance of how man even came to be to begin with, coming up and oozing from the primal mud of prehistory, you know, ascending the ladder of evolution and so on. It's very difficult for man to conceive the idea that this Earth is the one special place that God has invested. What would make us so special? His plan? Well, that's you can't try to convince the skeptic. But in the same way, sometimes it's almost been hard for the church to accept that fact as well, that this Earth is so special, or that his plan is so centric upon what will take place on this Earth. Because the assumption made is that if the Earth was destroyed in Genesis 1:1, then obviously the rest of the universe was also destroyed as well. Well, it wasn't. It's not destroyed. It's held together by the laws that God has created. Everything is working in sequence. God has seen to it that we are in perfect relationship to the moon, the sun, all the planets in our solar system, and it's all in synchronization to the point to where most of the time it's not too hot, except for July 13th. That was when, you know, things got a little out of whack. No, just kidding. But it's neither too hot nor too cold in most places on the Earth to sustain human life. But it's hard for people to believe that this is the only place in which that is possible. But it's my belief that there's nowhere else, because God didn't concentrate his efforts. And I don't get into that idea to believe that somewhere out there there's an alternate Earth or something. Just doesn't make any sense. So maybe sometimes you have to take a leap of faith and just believe, because we have a purpose and God has a purpose. In Isaiah chapter 14, we see the attempt, a couple of passages where that eternal purpose of God in reuniting with mankind and having an atonement with mankind was thwarted from the very beginning. maybe you might even say from a prehistorical point of view. In Isaiah chapter 14, beginning in verse 12, it says, "How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning." Son used to describe an angelic being once again. "How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. And I will also sit in the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north." And then here you see the beginnings of the wanton ambition. And all of the things that God says he hates in Proverbs 6, you find evidence of here. "I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, and I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the earth." So this three-verse prophecy is both historical, prophetic, and it weaves not only ancient history, prehistory, because history usually denotes man's occupation on this earth. It not only speaks about what happened prior to the creation of man, but what will happen at the time of his demise, and alerts us to that which will happen in the future. "Those who will see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, 'Is this the one?'" It wasn't a man, but "is this the one who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners?" The nations have been enslaved. Ephesians talks about the prince of the power of the air. "All the kings of the nations, all of them sleep in glory, everyone in his own house, but you are cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, like the garment of those who are slain, thrust through with the sword, who go down to the stones of the pit." The companion chapter, obviously, is the book of Ezekiel in chapter 28, where it describes the prince of Tyre, but then switches to speak about the king of Tyre. And so in verse 2, the prophet was said to go to the prince of Tyre. "Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, 'Thus says the Lord God, because your heart is lifted up and you say, I am a god and I sit in the seas and amidst of the seas, yet you're a man and not a god, though you set your heart as the heart of a god. Behold, you're wiser than Daniel.'" There seems to be some sarcasm there. "There is no secret that can be hidden from you. With your wisdom and your understanding, you have gained riches for yourself." This is speaking of the ancient prince of Tyre. And he embodies those same attitudes we find in Proverbs 6. The same exact attitudes, because it is those attitudes that have been filtered into mankind's brain, mankind's mind, by the deceptor. But in verse 12, there's a change. It says, "Son of man, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre, and say to him, 'Thus says the Lord God.'" And the description given fits and could possibly not fit any human being, past or present. "You were the seal of perfection." That's what God creates, perfection. "Full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering." Shows that the Garden of Eden was a type of the throne room, the palace, the area of God, where his throne is. "Every precious stone was your covering, the sardius, the topaz, and diamond, beryl, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and emerald with gold. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was created for you on the day you were created. You were the anointed cherub who covers." There, present, shown in the type of God's throne, to be angelic beings covering the throne room of God. There, present, didn't have to be hovering all the time, I don't suppose, but you get the point. He was there. It was present. as such, would have been privy to all of the plans, the documents, the blueprints, however that's done in the spirit realm, of all that God planned to do to recreate himself, in a prime position to understand what God was going to do. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you. You were on the holy mountain of God. Mountain being a synonym for government. He was there. He viewed the government of God. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you. God allows choice. Did not create evil. He allows choice. But here's what happened. By the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence within, and you sinned. I often wondered, how does a being trade? What currency does a spirit being trade in? They had everything available to them that they could possibly have. They had no want of anything in the spirit realm. They were at God's throne. But what did they trade? Pretty simple. Gossip. Rumors. All we have to do is look at how Eve was approached to know how the rest of the angelic realm, the third that rebelled, were approached. God has lied to you. He's told you not to take of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, because if you do, you'll be just like him. Now, how long this happened after his creation, we don't know if time or years or days or even relevant in the spiritual realm. But he sinned, broke the law of God. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I destroyed you, O covering cherub. Well, that will happen at a later time. Verse 17, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom for the sake of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I laid you before kings that they might gaze at you. You defiled your sanctuaries by the multitude of your iniquities and by the iniquity of your trading. Therefore, I brought fire from your midst. It devoured you. And all of that seems to be a prophecy for the future that follows this. So there's a clear difference between man and God in the book of Ezekiel, between the first part of the chapter and the latter part. And in whatever way, for however long it took, the trading in iniquity, law-breaking, and gossip convinced a third of the angels. We find in Revelation 12 that a third of the angels joined in that rebellion and tried to defeat God. Treachery. Deceit. Maybe you've considered it, maybe you haven't, that the emotional realm that we experience as human beings is similar to that that God has himself. Joy, happiness, but also at times despair because of law breaking and iniquity. I don't think it's a stretch to say that there was not only supreme disappointment, but there was the sucker gut punch feeling of being betrayed and being violated and having someone with whom you had had the best of intentions and plans and dreams for that particular being, for them to turn around as they did, not only him, but the rest of the rebellious angels who became demonic in their approach. I don't think it's a far stretch at all to say that that was a low point for the family of God, for the Father and the Son, emotionally speaking. In Leviticus chapter 16, we see another blueprint given to a physical nation and given specifically to the Levites that would outline how this can all be mediated for humankind. And it speaks of this day. And after the death of Aaron's two sons, when they violated God's laws, there were very specific instructions about what would take place specifically on this day, the Day of Atonement. In verse 2, the Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron your brother not to come just at any time into the holy place inside the veil before the mercy seat which is on the ark, lest he die. For I will appear in the cloud above the mercy seat. Thus Aaron shall come into the holy place with the blood of a young bull as a sin offering and out of a ram of a burnt offering. And he shall put on the holy linen tunic and the linen trousers on his body. And he shall be girded with a linen sash, and with the linen turban he shall be attired. These are holy garments. Therefore he shall wash his body in water and put them on. And he shall take from the congregation of the children of Israel two kids of goats as a sin offering, and one ram as a burnt offering. And Aaron shall offer the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself and for his house. And he shall take the two goats and present them before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats." Casting lots was to find out, what is God's decision? How does God rule on this? And there is a choice between two opposites as goats. Now, the goats were just animals. They represented nothing except for, they're nothing special except that they were just animals chosen for this person. "Then Aaron shall cast lots for the two goats, one lot for the Lord," specific, determined, and identifiable, "and the other lot for the scapegoat." Scapegoat. You know, just like collaborator to the French means something totally different, scapegoat carries a totally different meaning than what it was originally intended. Scapegoat was supposed to be the guilty one. A real collaborator is somebody that joins with you and helps. The collaboration of the French collaborators was evil because they aligned themselves with an evil purpose. And so the whole language has come to be changed around. Azazel, evil. Scapegoat is the wrong word here for Azazel, which is in the Hebrew. But it's subtle. Subtle. Scapegoat is somebody that is falsely accused of something he did not commit, and he takes the blame sometimes. That's what a real scapegoat is. This is not a scapegoat. All the blame, all the pain, agony, suffering placed on this typical goat was well deserved, well earned because of sin. Now, it's a type, as you realize. It's a physical thing. "Aaron shall bring the goat on which the Lord's lot fell and the other and offer it as a sin offering. But the goat on which the lot fell to be the scapegoat shall be presented alive before the Lord to make atonement on it and to let it go as an Azazel into the wilderness. And Aaron shall bring the bull of the sin offering, which is for himself, and make atonement for himself, and shall kill the bull as a sin offering, which is for himself." And then we find that, you know, throughout the rest of the chapter, this Azazel goat was taken out. There was one that was given as a sacrifice for the congregation, and there was one that was led away. In verse 16, "So he shall make atonement for the holy place because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel and because of their transgressions for all their sins. And so he shall do for the tabernacle of meeting which remains among them in the midst of their uncleanness. There shall be no man in the tabernacle of meeting when he goes in to make atonement in the holy place until he comes out, that he may make atonement for himself, for his household, and for all the assembly of Israel." In the book of Hebrews, it describes that all of these actions that took place under the old covenant were to lead us and guide us to a greater understanding, an understanding of what would ultimately happen at this particular time and this particular day. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 1. The author, whoever it was, my view, likely Paul, we don't know, so we'll call him the author. He's a good writer, though. Wrote an excellent book. Now, this is the main point. Okay, now really pay attention. This is the summation. We have such a high priest. We have such a high priest, as it mentions in the previous chapter in verse 26, for such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled. Not like Aaron or any other high priest that followed him. Separate from sinners and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily as those high priests to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once when he offered up for himself. Now this one is different, and we have such a high priest. A minister, verse 2 in chapter 8, of the sanctuary, of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. Verse 4, for if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve the copy and shadow of heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. And I thought that Mr. LaRavia had an excellent comment. What a great memory God imbued Moses with in order to remember every single detail when that plan was put into place. For he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, a better covenant, which was established on better promises. Much better promises. In verse 11 of chapter 9, it says, but Christ came as high priest of the good things to come, with the greater and more perfect tabernacle, not made with hands, that is, not of this creation, not with the blood of goats and calves, but with his own blood. He entered the most holy place once and for all, having obtained eternal redemption. Verse 15, for this reason he is the mediator of the new covenant by means of death, for the redemption of the transgressors under the first covenant, that those who are called may receive the promise of eternal inheritance. And that's what this day really points to and begins to make possible, this at-one-ment, where prior to this time, it was impossible for anyone else except for the high priest to go into the Holy of Holies. But now this explains that that way is made for all. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weakness, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. We don't need, in other words, on the Day of Atonement, two goats. They're readily identified in the Scripture. They're readily identified in this sermon. It's the fulfillment of those things. There's two opposites. There's one for the Lord and one for Azazel. Azazel, which freely translated means evil demon. Despite the attempts of this evil demon to obscure himself from the human race and to obscure his own reality, the Bible exposes him for the fraud that he is and that he became and why it happened. There was, anciently speaking, a sucker punch blow delivered to the family of God. And so I began with an unpleasant example of asking you if there had ever been anything like that ever happened to you. And certainly not a time where we ask for a show of hands. But I'll bet even kids can relate to that. Being betrayed, being made fun of, being bullied, it's all the same thing. Being talked about, not being popular, whatever it may have happened to you throughout your high school career or college or whatever, or being the object of derision in some way, the author of all of that is the devil. And it happened to God himself, to the Father and the Son. But there is a way to deal with that treachery and that iniquity. And we saw the physical example that is shown as a type in Leviticus 16. In Revelation 20, we see the fulfillment. Revelation 20 and verse 1, "Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold on the dragon, that serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, shut him up, set a seal on him, that he should deceive the nations no more." He won't. Coming to that time, hopefully very soon, to where that deception, that Azazel, will not be present any longer. So today marks the beginning of the end for all that we find written in Proverbs 6:16. The proud looks, the lying tongue, all of this has been foisted on an innocent humanity, hands that shed innocent blood, heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are running swift and running to evil, and a false witness who speaks lies. And especially the one who sows discord among the brethren. That is the devil. That is the Azazel goat, or the fulfillment of the Azazel goat. That is the type of the Azazel goat. Finally going to be put away, and isn't mankind going to be all the much happier and settled and peaceful when that influence and all that any of us have experienced in life that is negative in that way comes from that mind, comes from that treacherous, proud, ambitious, selfish mind, which is today put away.